meeting is now being recorded.
Thank you. It's Cheryl Langtonor again, and let's just get started with the usual administrivia that's involved in these meetings. First of all, Father Nate Stephen, I'd like to welcome you all to our 26th meeting of the Workstream to Support Organisation and Advisory Committee Accountability Working Group. We've got a slim but nevertheless important agenda for today's call, and what we'll need to do to begin with is do our usual request to people to let us know if you are only on the audio. If you're not able to join the Adobe Connect and you're only on the audio, let us know now. Not hearing anybody, we will take the roll call from the Adobe Connect room, and I will now ask if there is anyone who needs to make an update with their statement of interest. Not hearing anybody tell us that they've got a change in their employment or some substantial matter that may affect their work here with us. So we'll now move beyond the basic administrivia and ask if there's anyone, having looked at our draft agenda, that wants to make a proposed change to our agenda. Excellent. I do like silence in these circumstances. And so now I'll ask if there's anyone who wants to notify us that they have some any other business that they want to raise. We will be asking for any other business again at the end of the call. Good. Besieged by efficiency with our administrivia. Thank you, everybody. I'm going to now hand over to Stephen Fartinac, the bulk of the important parts of today's call. The first thing we're going to do with our agenda is very briefly note that at our last meeting we had some excellent discussion and some comments were discussed and developed based on the public comments and our discussions at the face-to-face meeting in Johannesburg, and in an action item out of that, two things were action items. One, some edits were going to be made to our documentation, and that was done and seen very kindly and very promptly distributed those to the list, and again repeated it earlier in what was my today, but may have been your yesterday. And that is the main reference document for today's call. And the other action item for us all was to make any comments and interventions that we might want to make in the intervening time to the Google Doc. And I believe that Steve will correct me if I'm wrong, and I hand over to him, that we didn't get any, if we got any, they were not substantial comments on that. So, Steve, over to you to bring us up to speed on our documents, and then we might just move straight into the substantial and primary agenda item for today, which is the beginning of our conversation and deliberations over good practices. Over to you, Steve. Can we get an audio check, Steve? Because I'm not hearing you.
How about now, Cheryl?
Perfect. Go ahead, Steve.
Thank you. Steve Dalbianco here. Thanks, everyone, for reviewing the modified report pursuant to the last call that we had. Brenda and Ashley have displayed in the Adobe the redline.pdf that I circulated first about 10 days ago and then again yesterday. There were no comments in either the Google Doc or that I saw on email among our group. So this isn't last call on these comments because we're going to be looking at this document in its entirety before we recommend it to the full plenary in the next couple of weeks. But it would be best if people had any questions about the changes in the red line in front of you Let me try to get those out of the way now before we move to the substance of today's call, which is to look at the specific public comments on changes that some have suggested to our good practices. Now, I will remind you that in this particular document, the one you have on the screen right now, we changed best practices to good practices and put it in brackets to show that it's a temporary term. I did update our track 2 recommendations, which is not to recommend mutual accountability roundtable for formal implementation. And on track 3, we didn't change our IRP recommendation, but we went further to explain that the Ombuds Office is the appropriate place, and they are chartered to handle challenges to an AC or SO action or inaction. So I thank Herb for his help with that. So I think right now, Cheryl, I'd be happy to take a cue from anyone who is want to comment on these changes, and if not, we'll be able to move ahead.
Thanks, Steve. Cheryl, for the record. I'm waiting for anyone to step forward or put their hand up more to the point for the cue.
Herb, you and Sebastian just pay particular attention to the bottom of page 1 where we describe the Ombuds Office, and then in more detail at the end of the report on the Ombuds too. Cheryl, seeing no hands, I think that we're probably good to go.
Let's move on, Steve. Yep, we're good to go. Thanks, Steve. Over to you again.
All right, so I'm going to scroll ahead in this report to the section on track 1. As far as you've indicated, we have public comments in a document that I recirculated yesterday. This is a document that Bernie Turcotte prepared for us, summarizing the public comments according to the tracks of the report, which makes it easier to work a track at a time rather than to take one particular commenter and run around our report to find where it belongs. So if you're able to look at track 1 on the screen, I'll scroll down to that. We only really need to look at this table, folks, the table that appears right here on pages 6 and 7. Because in that table are the recommendations that folks were commenting on. And we only have 5 comments on track 1 that we would need to get through today. Cheryl and Farzi, would it be appropriate then to just where I could describe the suggestion by a public commenter, and then we would all debate whether we want to, how do we want to respond? Would that be all right?
I think that's a good way forward, Steve. Cheryl, what about you, Farzi?
Yes, Farzi is speaking. Yes, thank you, Steve. I think that's a good approach.
All right, so the ISP, Internet Service Provider and Connectivity Provider, that's a constituency in GNSO. They had reservations to only one key item under recommendation 4 under transparency. I'm going to scroll the screen up. So take a look on the screen. You'll see transparency number 4 regarding meetings and calls. The ISPs believe that everything we have here is perfect for face-to-face meetings, but they believe that for conference calls, which is how the majority of constituency meetings occur, that for conference calls, it should be, the default should be members only. And of course, the chair could open it up to general public on a call. So just to reiterate, we have written here that both meetings and calls should normally be open. The ISPs are suggesting that face-to-face meetings should normally be open, and that we would add that conference calls of the constituency or group should normally be closed. Happy to take a cue on that. Cheryl, please.
Thanks, Steve. And I am actually queuing, Cheryl, for the record. And I'm queuing because I want to clearly make sure that everyone realizes I'm now speaking as a way of channeling on behalf of the at-large advisory committee and the at-large community. I think perhaps on this we may want to have a small variation to the proposed text, which may indicate something along the lines of, unless otherwise annotated or outlined in the rules of procedure of the advisory committee or support organisation, and then go on to the proposed text. My reasoning is that whilst this may work perfectly well for the ISPs and indeed various other component parts of the ICANN community and in particular the GNSO, the AOAC and that large advisory community work in the exact opposite, where by default in our rules absolutely everything is open, all conference calls, et cetera, unless we deliberately go in camera and then we have rules as to how we report about what happens in an in-camera. So I just want to take off my co-repertoire's hat and make sure that our group was aware of that. And whilst I've got that microphone, I should note one of the reasons that I'm doing that is that Alan Greenberg, who would normally be leading the charge on behalf of the ALAC, is, I believe, travelling home from his annual vacation. So he's wherever he's driving around, he's not able to join us today. So we should probably note him as an apology. Thank you, Steve. Thank you.
So, Cheryl, thank you for that, Cheryl. So what we'd like to note is that if we were to modify this good practice for the ISPs, we would be going into the opposite direction from the ALAC. Did I get that right?
Cheryl again. Yes, Steve, that is correct, but I think we could manage that variation with appropriately drafted text.
Okay. Let's go next in the queue. Greg Shatton.
Sorry. Hi, it's Greg Shatton for
sorry.
The record.
Sorry, I wasn't in the queue.
I'm sorry, Farzi. Farzi, I missed you.
Sorry,
Greg.
Farzi, I missed
my bad.
You. Greg, my bad.
Right, sorry about that. I just wanted to make the point that ISPC actually is saying that, recommending that at the stakeholder group and constituency, it makes sense that the meetings won't be open. So they don't have a problem with transparency SO and AC, and they think that it should be transparent by default. And I think what they're arguing is whether we should have a transparency rule by default or whether it should be closed and then the chair can make the meeting open. And for NCUC and NCSG, we have transparency by default and chair can decide whether to have a closed meeting. And I think ISPC actually is arguing the other way around. But as Cheryl said, we could say that these good practices, they should not go against their operating procedures of groups. And if groups have in their operating procedures that they will have closed meetings unless otherwise stated by the chair, then that might be an option. But I, for one, prefer that by default the meetings be transparent and open, and if the chair sees that in some circumstances should not be, they close it. But it might be different for businesses and other groups. Thanks.
Thank you, Farzi. Greg?
Hi, this is still Greg Shatton for the record. I think here there is no good practice. I think it's equally appropriate to have an open or closed meeting at the SG or constituency level. I think that stating that one thing is a good practice and the other is only as stated in the procedures, tips the balance one way or the other. Speaking in my role as president of the IPC, our membership meetings are member meetings, except at the actual ICANN meetings, and we have closed meetings as well as open meetings at those meetings. I don't think that there should be a prejudice preference in either direction for this. So I would put a bit of a variance on the ISP's suggestion and just think that whatever we have here should be basically straight down the middle. And you say that, you know, SG&T meetings can be either open or closed at the discretion of the group, either in their rules or from time to time as they desire. Thanks.
Thank you, Greg. You sound like you're mobile, so you're perhaps not looking at the actual recommendation. But in the context of what are called good practices, we say meetings and calls should normally be open. So we are being normative about what we think is good. We are not neutral in our recommendation. Now, the very next sentence says, when a meeting is determined to be members only, that is to say a meeting or call, that should be explained publicly, and we give typical reasons, not the only reasons, but typical ones. So we do bias towards open as being the good practice with an acknowledgement that the ACSO or group can choose to close it, but it should do so in good practice for reason, and it should publicly state that reason. So you're not just discussing how you feel about the ISP's recommendation. You're expressing a reservation with the recommendation we all approved earlier. I think, do I have that right?
No, that would be correct.
All right. Thank you, Greg. Appreciate that. Christopher Wilkinson.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Cheryl. I'm not comfortable with the ISP suggestion. I know which subgroups I'm a full participant of, usually manage to make their conference calls. But there have been several instances where one or other subgroup, of which I'm not a full participant, have raised issues that to which I have participated through email and through contact with members of the group. And when those particular issues have come up for discussion in a conference call, I have made an effort to join that conference call without any wish or aspiration to become a full member of the subgroup. So I'm going to read carefully the text that you've just referred to, Steve. It's 30 pages long and small print, and I'll get to it very quickly. But just to put a bémol, as we would say, a sort of a reserve, I would not like to be excluded from a conference call in another subgroup if there was an issue which I was particularly concerned with. Thank you.
Christopher, it's on page 6 of our document, and it's also in Adobe if you happen to be online. And our plenary supported this as a good practice. Under the good practice we've already supported, the business constituency could say that the following meeting is going to be closed or call, and at that point you would not be eligible to get in. That is the way the world works today for many of the constituencies. So you have the privilege of getting into any open meeting or call, but the way it works today, that if the AC or group decided to close a call, you could not get in. So you might be overstating the status quo.
Okay, I get it. I've never been excluded from a meeting that I really needed to participate in, so I'll take it and see, but I just did not want to have a general principle that conference calls could be closed. Thank you. I'll read the document and come back to you all.
Okay.
Thank
you. Christopher, I'm going to ask you to keep in mind the way things actually work today, and then and separately looking normatively to what we're saying are good practices, they're not required, but they're good, we are preserving the discretion of a group to close its meeting or call, and suggesting that they do so with public disclosure and that they explain why. And again, let me remind everyone that we do have specific text on what these good practices really mean. In other words, we are not insisting that they become part of the bylaws, that these good practices must be implemented. Instead, and I'll scroll up to the first page, the way we all agreed on our last call, the way we all agreed to say this, I'm very sorry for the jumping around here. I just need to go to page one. It's not as easy to control as I had thought it would be. Here we are on page one. And every time I touch the cursor, it's jumping around everywhere. I'm very sorry for this. All right, what we said is that we do not recommend that implementation of these practices be required, nor do we recommend any changes to the ICANN bylaws. We do recommend that operational standards for periodic organizational reviews conducted by ICANN could include an assessment of good practice implementation. And earlier, we had suggested that groups should implement to the extent the practices are applicable and an improvement over present practices. That doesn't really accommodate the notion that if a group wants to close all of its meetings by default, if an organization review 5 years from now said that your operational procedures actually don't match with these good practices, it would be a legitimate point that would be brought up in a review. We aren't really saying that none of these practices matter if your operational procedures say the opposite. I think the implication, everyone, is that a good practice should be considered by your groups, and if it's an improvement over what you're doing, you ought to change your procedures and your operating procedures. So it's not really saying that anybody's operating procedures can say whatever they want without regard to the good practices. The good practices are supposed to have some influence over what we think, over what a group does. So let's not just throw it out without worrying about the implications. We aren't requiring anything, but nor are we saying that everyone should ignore what we've come up with here. All right, next in the queue, Greg, your hand is up.
This is Greg chatting again for the record. I guess I'm thinking back to some of Alan's remarks, and sorry he's not here, and maybe I'm misinterpreting them in terms of our thought about good practices versus best practices. But conceptually, I think the idea is or was that these practices, that this is not one size fits all, and that some of these practices may legitimately not fit certain groups. So I guess the whole concept of normativeness, and that it would be a legitimate criticism that a group is not following the good practices, starts to make them sound very much like best practices. So I think we're kind of losing the distinction there with how normative we intend to be. So I think that needs to be taken into consideration in terms of how we're phrasing all of this. I'm getting a bit uncomfortable with the idea of, you know, kind of basically seems like favored and disfavored practices is how it's kind of breaking out. And I'm not entirely comfortable with the idea that, you know, for a particular group, if their practices are different from these practices, that they're disfavored. Thanks.
Okay, so the word disfavored never shows up anywhere. But let me remind you what we all agreed upon with the language last time, and this reflects Alan Greenberg's caveat. That was what he called it, a caveat. You'll see it right on page 8. So we suggested that the practices documented here could be reflected in the operational standards. The operational standards should also reflect recommendations that groups are only expected to implement good practices to the extent that they are applicable and an improvement. We do not recommend that implementation be required. So the word applicable doesn't mean in conflict, but the word applicable means that if you never have meetings, well, then it's not applicable to look at transparency of meetings. If you do have meetings and we have transparency good practices, then it's applicable. But you may feel, in your opinion, that the good practice is not an improvement over your present practice and could explain that easily. Because it's what we said in this caveat. This was Alan's key caveat. It's right there on page 8. It says, whether they're applicable and an improvement in the view of ACSO group participants. Not in the view of ICANN's hired consultant or some other ACNSO or public comment, but in the view of the group participants. So, Greg, I think that should give you some cause to relax, because we are not recommending the normative, favorable, unfavorable, and we are preserving the discretion about what is an improvement and whether it's applicable. We are reserving that discretion to the group itself. The IPC would determine whether they thought this was an improvement. Cheryl's indicating a check mark. Aubrey, I believe you were on the call when Alan put the caveat on the table. There were no objections to the caveat at that point. Aubrey, if you have a concern about it, please get in the queue and speak to it. And the answer is yes. Aubrey's noted in the chat that you could ignore this altogether. It might be pointed out in the review, and that would cause you to probably respond in writing as to why you're decided it's not applicable and not an improvement. Aubrey, go ahead, please.
Yeah, no. I would wish it weren't so, but, and I don't remember whether I was in the meeting, and I'm not really disagreeing with the caveat. I'm just indicating that by putting the caveat in, we've basically made it a null proposal and one that can be easily ignored. That's all I'm saying.
It can be ignored, Aubrey. I hope not easily. And that was the balance we sought to strike, because if these good practices are reflected in the operational standards that ICANN staff uses, then they hand those operational standards to the consultant that does the five-year review. The consultant examines those good practices versus what's actually happening in GNSO, in the case of you and I, and might indicate that there's differences. But their view cannot force, under our concept here, their view, the consultant's view, cannot force adoption of the best practice. Anyone else?
This is Aubrey again, if I can continue.
Please.
And I'm coming back in to respond. And I think, though, with the assurance that you're giving now to Greg, that it isn't even normative, that it isn't even an expectation or something, I thought you were saying that it isn't something one can be judged on because it's not normative. If you're saying that this is what you could do otherwise, i.e. there's a caveat if you really have a good reason, then what you're saying is it is normative, but there are exceptions, should, not a must. And that's fine. And so a caveat turns a must into a should. And that's fine. But if you go on to say, no, it's not normative, it's not the better practice, it's just something we're saying, then I think we've lost that. Then the caveat has really overcome the recommendation, is what I'm saying. I think the caveat is fine as a caveat, but it remains a normative recommendation, if I understood it before. But, you know, that's all. I'm really trying to understand how we're softening it as opposed to necessarily disagreeing.
Thanks, Aubrey. Let me see if I can recap. And page 8 is the most useful page to be on. In our earlier recommendation, which was approved by the plenary, we said to the extent that they're applicable and an improvement, they should be implemented. That's what we all approved. And then we did two things to it. We added a little bit of permanence to the good practices by suggesting that ICANN staff could put them into the operational standards. And I footnoted where all those come from. And then we added the Greenberg caveat to say that the judgment about whether things are applicable in an improvement is judgment of the AC and SO group and not the outside consultant. So it's more complex than to suggest whether it's normative. It's kind of normative, if there's such a thing as that. And the caveat is mostly about whose judgment applies to the question of whether it's an improvement. So perhaps this is a call to each of you to go to page 8 and read that over, put some comments into the Google Doc or respond by email, because we do need to get to the next item on our agenda. So we've gone off track on transparency because now we're examining the degree to which these are normative or recommendations. But if there's no further comments on that, I'll look forward to, well, you know, Avery, I'm sorry, I don't agree that it is much softer than what the plenary approved, because we have strengthened the degree to which it is examined as part of the organizational review as opposed to an ACRT review. There was a lot of pushback on putting it in the ACRT, and we are saying it can be put into writing in the operational standards, and at the same time we added the Greenberg caveat. So I think it's a balanced. The change we've made is a balanced change. It's not much softer, in my opinion. Okay? All right, we're back to the question on what to say about meetings being open and closed. So again, under transparency on page 6, what we had so far was that meetings should normally be open, and we indicate the kinds of reasons by which the AC and SO could simply close the meeting. And we've had a comment on both sides of that, and I'm not actually sure where we stand. I'd be grateful for anyone who could summarize where we are on this question of meetings. The IPC said they'd prefer that it be normally closed if it's a call. They were fine with face-to-face being normally open. I heard Greg didn't agree with the word normally to even be there, and Farzi and Cheryl seem comfortable with the way it's phrased right now. And Christopher, I think that you've reserved judgment and are going to get back to us. Is there anybody else? Okay, I think we're going to note that we have a mixed reply on this one. The next public comment, and thank you, Avery. Avery's noting okay with the way it is.
Greg, is Cheryl here. Is that a new hand?
That's a new hand. First, quickly, I agreed with Steve's characterization of where we are in terms of the level of normativeness here, and that we're kind of at the should level overall. On this point specifically, before we leave it, I think that the ISPCP, I wish there was one of their members on the group on the call to talk about it directly, but the way I see it is that having accepted that these are normative, at least at the level of should, maybe call them better practices, then they would rather have their normative practice be the normative practice, and have to explain why you're not doing what they do rather than have the opposite. Even there, you know, you have to argue somehow about whether it's an improvement or not, and you have to make an argument about it or a reason as opposed to just discretion, which at least in legal documents means you don't need to explain why you're doing it. So I think that's why the ISPs came out the way they did. My concern was that, you know, if we or my suggestion was we don't set a normative practice at all. I can see that's, you know, I'm alone in that at the moment. I'm uncomfortable with the ISP's suggestion, but I'm also uncomfortable with the opposite because, you know, either one is a judgment. what I consider to be membership meetings. And I think the ISPs have kind of done what they've done because they're taking the normative field and playing with it in order to, you know, basically state that their practice, which I will say is also the IPC's practice, you know, should be the normative one. So that's the problem, of course, with making normative statements about groups that have different practices. You're saying that some people's practices are better than others. The norm, I see Avery says they would like to flip the norm on its head. I don't know what the norm is for stakeholder group and constituency meetings. I've never tried to attend a registry stakeholder group or registrar stakeholder group meeting. So I don't know what the norm is among stakeholder groups and constituencies of the GNSO. And how that has played out. So if we're going to make a judgment about stakeholder group and constituency meetings, I think we need to be clear about normative, about this. And you know, I think maybe we've kind of rolled a little too quickly over this.
Greg, this is Steve.
To clarify, in case you're not in the... In case you're not in Adobe, the ISPs said they're fine with the recommendation when it comes to face-to-face meetings, but they want to flip it on its head for calls, that when they have calls, they would normally be closed unless open. So all the ISPs are doing is a sort of a trying to bifurcate recommendation for transparency number 4 so that we would have two sets of norms. The norms for face-to-face are different than the norm for a call. I think that is their recommendation. I realize that the rest of this discussion is completely inbounds and appropriate, but it's not really what the ISPs are recommending. Greg, you still have the floor?
Yeah, I understand what the ISP's recommendation is. I'm saying that, in a sense, it goes too far. I don't think we should be making a normative judgment that meetings should be closed for all groups, that calls, rather, should be closed for all groups. So I'm uncomfortable with that. I'm also uncomfortable with the idea that saying that it's essentially a not good practice to close phone calls. So that's ultimately my concern. So you have to decide. I'm not sure where that leaves us. In a sense, I could support the ISP's recommendation because that at least puts the norm, takes the judgment away from closed member phone calls.
It does not take judgment away.
In both cases, whether you're face-to-face or closed, the judgment of whether to switch that is completely in the hands at the time of the constituency or stakeholder group itself. It's appropriate for us to respond to public comments. At the time of the meeting, right. So the judgment is all still there. And it's appropriate for us to respond to public comments in a way that that shows that we're listening. But I don't think we can go back to the plenary and say, on second thought, we never meant that meetings and calls should normally be open. The public comments we received don't support a reversal. The ISPs are asking for more fine-grained detail between face-to-face and meetings, and face-to-face and calls, suggesting that they're different. So I'm less comfortable telling the plenary that 3 or 4 of us got on this call and decided to undo what we all approved earlier, and would probably bias against changing it at all if we can't come up with a better reason that's supported by public comment. This is a plenary document, but we are the drafting team at this point, determining how to respond to public comments.
Cheryl here, Steve.
Please.
Thanks, Steve. Cheryl Langdon for the record. I think that brings me back to some extent to exactly what I said in the beginning when I intervened wearing my large advisory committee representative hat rather than my co-rapporteur one. And that is in response to this particular public comment, I think we note and recognise their concern and that we clarify that the ability to have internal rules that best suit the entity is maintained, but that the primary directive, the normative, the greatest support from all of us is that the default be open, that is in keeping with not only ATRT2 but ATRT1 recommendations, as Avery has pointed out. But that we say, unless otherwise decided, agreed, or enshrined in the rules of procedures or operating procedures of the entity, that this normative good practice be the case. So it's not giving the open wiggle room, which I see Avery quite justifiably is concerned about, but it allows for, let's face it, what are component parts of one support organisation, albeit a very important one, but it is this sort of multifactorial approach we have to take because of the differences between not only the contracted and the non-contracted party house within the GNSO, but in the subsections of those two houses with the variability of their rules. So I would hate to see that a third and fourth level rule set is impinging on an advisory committee or council behaviour. But I'm happy to find text that allows for such variability to still be seen as good practice. Thank you.
Thank you, Cheryl. I'm going to move on to the registry's public comment because it's related to this topic. The registries point out, and they support the recommendation under transparency, that they're wondering how we can reconcile the transparency of meeting minutes with confidential matters that gave rise to the closure of a meeting in an applicable way. So number 5 under transparency says, quote, notes, minutes, or records of all membership meetings should be made publicly available. And the registries go on to the very next section, which is participation, where number 4 under participation said, for any meetings, be they closed or open, the members will have access to notes, minutes, and recordings subject to exceptions for confidential matters. So the way we've worded it, we probably have an inconsistency, and there were others who pointed this out in the past, and we probably need to reconcile this. We said here that the members have access to the notes, minutes, and recordings. We didn't say that everyone in the general public has access to notes, minutes, and recordings. And then we said subject to exceptions for confidential matters. And we don't actually describe what are confidential matters. And a third public comment asked us to explain what confidential matters was, potentially indicating that we point to the same list of reasons that are in the 5 bullet points under transparency item 4, trade secrets, sensitive, invasion of personal privacy, potential harm to security and stability, et cetera. So we had, from the transparency group, we imported 5 standard reasons for closing a meeting or call, and I would submit to you that we would point to the same 5 reasons with respect to the word confidential under participation. That clarification doesn't solve the inconsistency. The inconsistency is under transparency item 5, publicly available notes, minutes, and records, versus participation number 4. that notes, minutes, and recordings, which is different than the word records, recordings, are available to members, but not to the general public. So this is partly a reflection of the fact that we went through quite an extensive list of operational procedures for all of the ACs, SOs, and subgroups, and they differ. Because they differ, when we boil them together into the good practices, we have inherited an inconsistency. So this is a dilemma no less perplexing than the one we just covered on what to do about meetings. And the dilemma is what to do about recordings, notes, and minutes of a meeting if it contained the kind of confidential matters which we acknowledge are appropriate reasons to close a meeting. Cheryl.
Thank you, Steve. Cheryl, for the record. And I did mention in one of my earlier interventions that in the case of the at-large advisory committee and the at-large community, which includes the regional at-large organisations, when they go, because they are by default open and public, as is absolutely every transcript, every recording, every dotted I cross T and joke and everything else is in perpetuity out there in the internet. However, when they do go in camera, they go in camera under their rules of procedure so that they state they are going in camera for the purpose of recordings are stopped. Only those who would be considered the appropriate members, so that would be perhaps in the case of the at-large advisory committee, the ALAC and not other leadership from the RAVOs, etc. Or it may be the leadership team if they're talking about personality issues of who's going to be elected to what and why. And recommendations and things. So regardless, why the meeting's being closed at that time, for what purpose, it is then closed, recordings are stopped, no transcript is maintained, there may be separate and confidential notes held, but they are totally held separately, and then in the public record, but it could be the member record just as easily, the outcomes of that in-camera session is recorded. So it would be closing for the purpose of discussion of individuals nominated for XYZ position, blank space in the record, time stamp put in, the at-large advisory committee met and discussed blah, 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 and we'll now go to a vote. So it allows a continuity of what happened without the details. Now, I'm not suggesting that we need to go into that type of detail, but I think what that outlines is that with the flexibility of developing good practice within the component parts of ICANN, we can manage this. But I would also encourage us to recognise that if one makes something available to the public, it is by default, therefore, available to one's members. But one could certainly make something available to one's members and it not be a public archive. Thank you.
Thank you, Cheryl. On page 18 of our document is the detail we received from ALAC, which I believe was submitted by Alan several months ago. And there's no discussion there, this in-camera option. It might be in the written procedures, but it didn't make its way into the document. All it says about ALAC under transparency is that meeting minutes, recording, and transcripts are published. It doesn't acknowledge the in-camera exception, which sort of would take it out of the recording, right? If you turn the recording off, I get that. And we don't clarify whether it's published to the public or only to membership. And so we're still back. I mean, I appreciate that you clarified for us what it is that the ALAC actually does versus what we documented. But I don't know that that gets us any closer to resolving the inconsistency in our own report. with respect to if we have allowed something to be closed, if the whole meeting is closed, well, then the minutes and recordings include everything that is said, not just an in-camera for a few moments as we discuss a sensitive matter. And I've done it that way on other boards that I serve on. But the way we've written this here is that the entirety of a meeting that was closed, that we're not clear about whether the entirety of that meeting is published only to members or published to the general public. And I would say that this is probably surfacing a vulnerability in our recommendations that has been caught in the public comment, is that we need to reconcile the notion of, is the entire meeting closed or only a portion of it? And if there are recordings, minutes, and notes taken, are they available to the general public? Or in some cases, are we saying it's fine for them to be restricted only to the membership? We ought to take a cue on that. Since I need to see it's a clarification, not a reversal of what the plenary approved. Aubrey.
Aubrey speaking. Yeah, I think that if we do anything, it should be parallel, that any section of a meeting, and I know this creates a technical issue, and I don't want to get into how we solve the technical issue, though it's probably doable, but basically, if you close a section of the meeting with proper reason, explanation, et cetera, as per everybody's rules, then that portion of the recording should also be restricted to that same audience. In other words, if it's closed to members, then that bit of the recording should only be open to members, whether that means stop and start a recording or what have you, when you go into closed session. One way I've seen meetings start is you have a decision at the beginning that one part of the agenda towards the end is going closed, and at that point you close recording and open another and have different distributions. But I think we can come up with something that parallels the other rule. Thanks.
Thank you, Aubrey. Farzi, you're next in the queue. But Aubrey, I did want to note a practice is that in GNSO, the commercial stakeholders groups, when we close a meeting, then the entirety of the meeting includes this kinds of discussion that would be redacted, as opposed to getting to an open meeting where a tiny segment of it. And that's just a noted difference and would require some significant adjustment if we ended up saying that it's the portion of the meeting that is subject to redaction in the recording, the transcript, and the notes. And as a practical matter, I don't know who on the ICANN technical staff would go to the portion of the recording and then somehow cut out that audio for the MP3 that's published to the public. I think there's a technical concern there as well. Farzi.
Thanks, Steve. Just wondering, should we change the recommendation number 5 to be consistent with number 4, that the recording and the mailing list should be open to public unless otherwise stated, or like there are reasons that, and then also we clarify that under what circumstances it should be, it can be closed and only available to the members. Just just to say, our practice at NCUC, what we do is that our mailing list and our executive committee mailing list is open. And we put the recordings on the website, but sometimes we have closed meetings when there are reasons to have closed meetings, such as like when we want to talk about like a candidate or for a position or something like that. Thank you.
Farzi, I want to note that what you described is exactly what's on page 6 It says meetings and calls should normally be open to public observation. And number 5 says notes, minutes, or records should be made publicly available. So you're restating exactly what was in our recommendation, but we need to address the inconsistency between that and what is under participation number 4. Participation number 4 is not consistent with that. All right, we have our work cut out for us, and with only 3 minutes left, we aren't going to get it done today. And I would submit we probably aren't going to solve this unless more members of this group do a little thinking and reading and writing between this call and our next call. I would so encourage the members of our group to give it some thought and put recommendations on an email list. I will volunteer to start it by just giving you each a tiny little segment, an excerpt from what the registries have said, what the ISPs have said, and I'll try to tee up this inconsistency in a single email, and hopefully that thread will stimulate reaction to it. And it would be my request that that thread stay focused on the inconsistency between transparency and participation, and maybe a separate thread, if you wish, on the whether the default is open or closed. So with that, Cheryl, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you, everybody, for what I think has been a useful progression of the fine-tuning of our report. And that's exactly what we will be continuing on with over the next few meetings. As Steve has suggested, let's get some of this work done on the list. Please do interact with the Google Doc if you are able to do so. Our next steps are outlined in the agenda. I don't think we need to review them again now. I do need to assure you, however, and what we might do is transmit to the list, if you don't mind, Brenda, the PowerPoint slide that shows the current timeline for a June 2018 end of the Workstream 2 project. I think we're on track, so that's not too much of a problem from our point of view, but I think it's important that we are brought up to speed with what will be key milestone dates and meeting times for us to progress to finish our work as the current budget extension is allowed for. With that, I want to remind you all that in today's agenda is the dates and times for all of the August meetings. Our next meeting will be on Thursday, the 3rd of August at 1900 UTC. And I will now ask if there is any other business that anyone wishes to raise that they weren't able to raise earlier. I don't believe there is. And with that then, not seeing anybody raising a hand and waving frantically to get our attention on AOB, on behalf of Fazlin and Steve and myself, I want to thank you all for the time, energy and effort you've put into today's call and encourage you to put in a tad more time, energy and effort into our list work between now and our next meeting. And with that, we're at the top of the hour. We'll close today's call and stop the recording. Thank you one and all. Bye for now.